Blog Talk Radio.
Hands behind your head.
Your wish is my command.
Okay. Put a robe on or something, but no tricks.
Yes, sir. Oh, watch out for my husband. He'll trip. Clever, quick, but so easily distracted.
Why this?
Oh, it's not like I killed him. He did it to himself about an hour ago. It's all the fault of this damn Vaz.
You are a common criminal.
There's nothing in common about me.
You're a criminal, and I'm bringing you in for the murder of a fence named Donnefeld.
If you're gonna lock me up, do it over something I'm actually guilty of, stupid.
Oh, you're guilty of a lot.
I haven't shot anybody in days.
Those are moments from the new, highly anticipated film, The Spirit, which opens up nationwide on Christmas Day. And we'll be discussing The Spirit tonight with an actor in the film, a terrific actor and a good friend of ours into the show, Mr. Louis Lombardi, and the visual effects supervisor, Stu Mashwitz, in just a couple of moments. But first, this is Movie Geeks United, and I am one of your co-hosts this evening. My name is Jamie.
And I am Jerry, and it is a pleasure to have you here tonight.
It's a terrific show tonight, as usual, our pre-holiday show. Are you ready for the holiday season, Jerry?
It just sort of crept up on me, but I am ready. I went to a very nice, my friend of mine's graduation party / holiday party earlier, and I'm ready.
Yeah.
I am ready.
Yeah, I'm not. I usually do my shopping on Christmas Eve because Walgreens is open 24 hours a day.
Walgreens is a beautiful place.
I mean, what more do you need? What do you need? What could you possibly need that isn't carried to Walgreens?
I have no idea.
That's Christmas in a nutshell.
I have an important announcement to make.
What's that?
I ordered a Blu-ray player today.
Oh, good.
Yeah, after all that, yes. Finally.
You've already got a library of like 200 titles. So
I know, really. It's about time.
We got a great show for you tonight. Also on the show tonight, Blog Talk Radio's very own Dr. Blogstein is going to be joining us, and he'll be playing a little bit of his upcoming interview with Ernest Borgnine. Talk about one of those legends that is still around, still thriving.
Oh, man, the Wild Bunch, Ice Station, Zebra.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. It doesn't get any
Absolutely.
Better than that.
And we're going to end the show tonight also. We're wanting to spotlight a really terrific film called Where God Left His Shoes, which contains one of John Leguizamo's very best performances. And it's out now, and it's a terrific film to see. We're going to speak to the director of that film, Mr. Sue.
Sal Stable.
Sal Stable, yes. He'll be joining us. But let's get right to our first segment. Directed by Frank Miller and based on the renowned comic series by Will Eisner, The Spirit is an eye-popping visual spectacle populated by some of our great actors, including Samuel L. Jackson, Eva Mendes, Scarlett Johansson, and one of our first guests tonight, Mr. Louis Lombardi. Mr. Lombardi has appeared in a stunning roster of films, including The Usual Suspects, Suicide Kings, Natural Born Killers, Confidence, and Wonderland, as well as landmark television series such as 24, The Sopranos, and Entourage. And you may recall his first appearance on our show just a short time ago as he discussed Doughboys, the terrific film he recently wrote, directed, and starred in that is now available on DVD. Joining him tonight to discuss The Spirit is also the visual effects supervisor of the film, Mr. Stu Mashwitz. He's a director, the author of the DV Rebels Guide, and one of the most accomplished visual effects talents in the business. Just listen to some of these credits. The Star Wars Special Editions, Blade Runner's Director's Cut, Galaxy Quest, Deep Impact, Men in Black, Sin City. I could go on and on and on.
Right there, just what you mentioned, what more do you need?
You don't need anything more than that.
Yeah.
It's like Walgreens on Christmas Eve. You don't need anything more than that.
You just compared our guest to Walgreens. I don't know. All right, let's get this ball.
Okay. It's a tremendous pleasure to welcome Mr. Louis Lombardi and Stu Mashwitz to Movie Geeks United. Hi, gentlemen. How are you guys doing?
Hey, how you doing?
Welcome.
Hey, guys. Great to be here.
Hey, it's great to have you guys with us. Louis, we spoke to you about, I think it was a month and a half, 2 months ago, maybe, and we talked to you about your beginnings in the business. I want to get a sense from Stu on that, how you came into the business and what kind of role visual effects and what kind of movies played a role in your life.
I went to film school. I've always been into movies and photography. I actually went to animation school, the California Institute of the Arts, in sort of a proud tradition of never doing exactly what I was supposed to be doing, I, instead of getting my animation degree, I spent my whole time screwing around making live-action movies and doing special effects for them in whatever way I could at the time. So the weird thing that happened was that at the end of my 4 years in film school, I had a reel full of special effects that I had done, which got me a job at Industrial Light and Magic. So that's where I got to work on some of those movies like Star Wars and Men in Black. And after about 4 years of that, I joined a couple other ILM expats, and we started a little film company called The Orphanage, where we do original productions and visual effects for movies.
Right, right. And was, I would imagine that Star Wars would be of a particular influence on you, as it was for a lot of people our age.
Yeah, that's the quintessential, you know, movie that I saw when I was at just that right age where I just pointed at the screen and said, I want to do that. Whatever that is, I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So that had to be really thrilling to finally get your chance to work with that team.
Yeah, absolutely. Personally, I still prefer the original, but it doesn't bother me at all that my name is in the credits of the of the special
edition. No, of course, I can't imagine it would.
No, it's all right, you know. But after that happens, after you get your name in the credits of the movie that got you interested in being in the movie business, it does make you start thinking about what the next thing ought to be, and so that's kind of part of what inspired me to leave and join Scott Stewart and John Rothbard in forming The Orphanage.
Right. And Louis, had you had prior to The Spirit, had you had much experience acting in an environment like this that is dependent upon visual effects as The Spirit is?
No, not at all. This was my first experience, and it was great. I mean, it was great. I mean, I learned a lot from watching Stu do a lot of stuff. So, I mean, it was just fascinating, you know?
Yeah. And how much interaction did you guys have together? Does Stu have with the actors?
Every day. He was like my babysitter. Like when you go and somebody has to burp you and make sure you clean up the blood and the wipe and making sure your bald head is nice and shiny and getting killed 50 different ways. That's where Stu comes in. Yeah, Stu is great. Let me tell you something. One of the best guys I ever worked with. I got to tell you the truth.
Oh,
he was great.
All right.
Well,
that's
beautiful.
So nice to hear, man.
No, he was like, even like he was directing some of the stuff that we did, you know, because he's like, it was so massive. And, you know, me and him would be working together a lot. And it was just great working with him, I got to tell you.
Yeah, I basically directed what we called the Louis Torture Unit, where...
And he ain't kidding, it was torture.
It was torture. Louis plays about 100 roles in the film. He plays like a cloned henchman to the octopus, and so a lot of what he is doing involved a lot of what I was doing in terms of doing, you know, multiple Louis on screen at once, and so... I had the great pleasure of working with Louis on a routine basis, except that it was always in some way I was squibbing him up or pushing him off something or putting him up on a platform. And it was never like, it was never an easy day, but man, you were always such a good sport. We had such a good time.
Thanks. And I would be like, well, how's this going to look? So he'd be like, hold on, click, and show me like in 5 seconds, like stuff that it was going to look like. I'm like, wow, that looks great. All right, what do you want to do next, you know? You want to hit me in the head with an Advil as it drops from a building? All right, go ahead.
But that's something, because you really do have to give the actors, they have to really have a sense of what this is going to be. They have to visualize it very specifically. Isn't that, that would be the case, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for my part, I certainly tried to do that, although I always feel like the actors are one step ahead of me in that regard. You know, I don't know what your experience is, Louis, acting in front of a green screen, but it seems to me that I guess the common idea would be that the director is waving their hands around and saying, it's going to look amazing, it's going to be awesome, but my technique would be more to do what you say, like put it on my laptop and kind of
right.
try to show a rough idea of what it would be like. And
right, and that was so helpful. That was like the most helpful thing. Every time I would do something, I would turn to Stuart, it would be like an immediate reaction. Like, look, like, you know, am I going to see what it looks like now? You know, and he would. He would pull it right up, and he would show this, and he would show me everything, and, you know, it really helped me. It helped me more than just acting alone in front of the green screen. I mean, that was
sure.
the biggest help I've had on doing it like this, because then I saw where I was, what I was doing, who else I was talking, you know. It just helped massively doing that like that, and I really appreciated that, you know.
Oh, good. Good.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the world that you guys are creating in this, but first of all, Louis, in terms of green screen acting, where you really have to go entirely on your imagination. Was that a particular challenge for you? Was that difficult to kind of get in the swing of? Or
you know what? In the beginning, it was like just a couple of days getting used to it. But after a while, they lay out certain scenarios. Like if you're on a street with a fence, the street and the fence is there, but not the buildings and the
right.
snow.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you basically have 50% of what you would see. You know, not 50, but I would say like 30, 35% of what you would see on set. Right, Stu? What do you think about
that was a big priority for us. I think, you know, it'd be too easy or too kind of, I think, lazy to just go on the stage with a bunch of green and just figure it all out later. So we
right.
did build sets, and we gave ourselves the luxury of, even if there was only a minimal set, we would still kind of treat it like it was the set. We would tape it off on the ground, and we'd keep our lines of our eye lines consistent between takes and things like that, so that you weren't. I think it's easy to get kind of dizzy on a set like that, and because there is an efficient way to shoot that kind of thing where you literally have nothing
mm-hmm.
nothing to go off of, and you can do what they call French reverses, where you're just always the camera's always looking in the same direction, and everyone has to just imagine that the set spins 180 degrees. That kind
right.
of gives me a big headache. So we tried to avoid that. We had the luxury of avoiding that because. You know, the producers set up an amazing, luxurious working environment for us where we had 360-degree green on two stages, and we could have these two units going at once.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was amazing how big and massive they were. Like, every stage you go, all you see is, like, oceans. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. It was very well set up in that way.
It's interesting because you mentioned that some of it had to be practically built. And the technology is such where you can create any world, but it's kind of a danger too. We spoke to the cinematographer. He's currently working on Tron 2 now.
We spoke with
him last week.
I listened to
and
that
he said,
show. That was great.
Oh, thank you, man. And he said he's surprised they're actually building a lot of practical sets for it. Is that important to kind of know when not to use visual effects because you can overload the film? With that kind of technology?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, my primary job, I think, on the set was to try to keep us from using too much visual effects. You know, I think they wound up building a lot more sets than we ever thought we were going to. It is, you know, you're absolutely right. It's in a world where you can do anything, it's very easy to do a bunch of stuff that you really shouldn't do. And film, you know, is a expressive medium, but it's really defined by its limitations, you know. And audience is used to the camera being able to do a certain thing, and
mm-hmm.
you know, there are certain directors who are really interested in breaking down those barriers and flying cameras through keyholes and doing sort of impossible things. But Frank Miller is not one of those filmmakers. He's a real traditionalist, and he and I are of like mind on that. We kind of both feel like there's nothing really broken about traditional filmmaking. It works really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in an odd kind of way, we both agreed that we wanted to make a more kind of traditional-looking movie using this you know, new technique.
Right.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what the movie is. Louis, can you tell us a little bit about the plot behind The Spirit and the 100 characters that you play in it?
Well, the plot's like a total, like, when I did, and I, like I said, these are like my, this film, when I saw it the other night, I was like just watching it going, this is unbelievable. I mean, the mm-hmm. colors, the style, the way it looks, I mean, it's visually like filling, like where it fills you up when you're watching every single thing on camera. Like I was astounded by it. You know, it's a crime fighting kind of thing about the, you know, about the spirit saving the, you know, his city and fighting the octopus who Samuel Jackson's unbelievable in. I mean, I love working with him. Working with him was great. It was like every scene he did, you felt like you were in a theater. Like he was just so strong.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
you know, that's why he gets to play all these villains, I guess, and these characters.
He's an expert at green screen.
Oh, my God.
The
I mean, I was so fortunate to work with him because, you know, this is my first time. And as an actor working with another actor doing it, it was kind of like, you know, like you said, he was a pro at it, and I just followed him in a lot of ways, and
mm-hmm.
you know, he made it easy for me. And I just think the movie is visually stunning. I have to say, from the special effects to the colors to what they added in around us, because I didn't see anything. And like when they added the buildings and the snow to the streets we were on, it was like, wow, I couldn't have imagined stuff
mm-hmm.
like this.
Right.
You know.
I have a question for Stu.
Sure.
And
yeah.
I just watched the director's cut of Sin City, a movie that I love.
Yeah.
And I know there's a huge difference between The Spirit and Sin City. But for
good,
you,
I'm so
what
glad
were the
to hear you say that.
No. No, trust me. I know my I actually got a thing from the Smithsonian when I was a little kid about The Spirit. I got in a hardback, all the classic comics and The Spirit
yeah.
was in there.
Oh, cool.
So I know there's a difference between the two. Unfortunately, I know for the regular film goer, they're going to be, "Oh, this is looks like a retread of Sin City." And everyone on this show right now knows that's not true.
Yeah.
We know they're not related at all. But for you, what were you, and especially for Frank Miller, I guess, what were the challenges to make sure that you weren't retreading on the same ground as Sin City?
Well, I think, you know, in Sin City there was this idea of reverence going on, and that really came from Robert Rodriguez. You know, Robert and I both, you know, were just huge fans of the Sin City graphic novels. And, you know, Frank would wince to even hear me call them graphic novels. He prefers the term comic book, you know. And
oh, he does?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, he's like taking the term back, you know.
I admire that, okay.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So we were big fans of the comic books, and there was this mutual impulse on both of our part to, you know, really be reverential to that. And I think Frank was the one who was like, "Hey, let's try other things." And Robert was always the guy who was like, "No, we're going to make it look just like the page, you know. Mm-hmm. We're going to put the page on the screen," which is really
yeah.
fun and a huge opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to Frank early on about The Spirit, it was clear that reverence was the last thing on his mind, that he felt that Eisner's work on The Spirit was all about breaking new ground and trying new things. And he's often quoted as saying that Eisner would rise from the grave to throttle him if he ever felt that Frank was being too reverent to the material.
I could see that, definitely.
Yeah, so, you know, it's what Frank is really taking is that intention of just experimentation and trying and breaking out of the traditional boundaries of the media, and that was, you know, a cool thing to be a part of. Then on top of that, also just discovering, talking to Frank more, that he's a real lover of film, and he doesn't think there's anything wrong with how movies look, you know. He doesn't think they need to look more like comic books, and so we were able to work with cinematographer Bill Pope, you know, who is, of course, an amazing genius, to
mm-hmm.
craft a look for the film that I think owes more to the look of film noir and cinema than to comic books. So, you know, whereas Sin City, there's this kind of idea of reverently putting the comic book up on the screen. I think going into The Spirit, it was much more about, let's just make a movie, and let's make a movie inspired by The Spirit, but let's not be slavish to the details.
Well, you see that. I mean, you see that in the graphic novel of Sin City, and especially for the graphic novel 300, you see that Frank Miller loved, obviously, the old Hollywood epics in regard to 300. But in Sin City, you see, and I'm not talking about the film, I'm talking about the graphic novel,
yeah.
You see this wonderful admiration for the film noir of the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Absolutely.
It's all there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Frank Miller, and you see that in The Dark Knight Returns, you see that in Ronin, you see that in The Dark Knight Strikes Again. Frank
yep.
Miller, you know, I wish I had that brain, but I really do. And he's a genius, and I think Frank Miller's contribution, you see his influence in the two Christopher Nolan Batman films.
Absolutely.
You could not have Batman Begins without The Dark Knight Returns. I don't think you could have that. I mean, Frank Miller just is his wealth of imagination. But, I have a question for Lewis. What was it like working with Frank Miller?
Oh, it was great, man. Let me tell you something. First of all, as a director, as a person, he's great. That's why actors love him, because he's so respectful and, you know, and such a, and like a, just a gentleman. He doesn't feel like you're directing you. He feels like he's communicating with you. And, you know, you're almost willing to do anything he says. You know, I was. I mean, X, too. He's like, all right, we're going to do this. We're going to tell you under this. We're going to do this. I was like, all right. You know,
absolutely.
After a while, you just feel like, you know, you have somebody that you're dealing with that isn't just a, you know, some director from Hollywood screaming at what he wants.
Right.
You know, you really feel like he's talking about what he cares about and he loves what he's doing. You know, and it isn't about the director role. It's about, let's make this stuff come to life and this is what I see. Even when I first met him for the role, he was telling me what he was going to do with the movie a year and a half ago, and I was like, wow, that sounds insane.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like we were on set going, I'm going to do this with a bullhorn. You know, he was in a room, like, looking at me, and I was like, wow, this guy's scaring me. I can't wait to work with him.
No, what I like about him, he said when actually right before 300 came out, and he was talking with Zack Snyder, and Zack Snyder wanted to do all these grandiose things, and he said, Frank Miller said this, you know, because Zack Snyder, I think, wanted to make this big political statement. He said, remember, we are making a movie for 13-year-old boys. He said, they don't really give a flying fuck about the war in Iraq.
Sure.
They want to enjoy themselves.
Yeah.
And you got to hand it to Frank for, you know, he just said, look, we're making a movie for boys. Let's give them the time of their life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Tell me about the... how long it took to kind of, how long was the shooting schedule and how long was the actual conception and visual effects work? And Louis, were you brought in at all for that after the regular shooting to do some more work with the effects?
Oh, yeah, I came back like for a week, right? I think still afterwards to do a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, you came in for our last week of shooting, I think, because we just had a couple little things to finish up. But we... I mean, the shoot was entirely contained within like a 3-month window in Albuquerque, Albuquerque Studios. Mm. But we did, you know, Louis is involved in one of the more complex effects sequences, and I don't want to give anything away, but I definitely got to work with Louis not just in terms of, you know, blowing him up and killing him in various ways, but also in preparing. to use just his head for an elaborate sequence. So we definitely had some effects intensive shoots with Louis.
And can I tell you something still, without giving anything away, when I was at the premiere tonight, all those kids were coming over and they were freaking out about that. when you were just talking about, they were like, oh my God, can we get one of those? Is there a dollar made of that? I was like, I don't have no idea. But the kids in the bathroom, like those 13, 12-year-old kids when I saw them, they were flipping out over that.
Oh,
I heard them, and they didn't even see me, and I heard them.
Sort of like an octopus experiment gone awry.
So tell me about that, watching it with a crowd and their reaction to it that you guys have both experienced.
No, man, for me it was insane. It sounds like the same for you, Louis. It was just seeing it with an audience was, you know, in every way, everything I had hoped it would be. It was great. People seemed to really love it. They laughed at all the right parts. They're girls behind me crying at the end. It was, you know.
And it goes by really fast, man. The movie just whips. You're watching it, and with all the action and just the interestingness of this film, you're just watching it going, wow, and you're trying to catch up in your mind almost because you're trying to watch stuff, reverse it in your head to catch it on. And, I mean, like I said, I you know, this is like my first kind of film like this, and I really haven't gone to the movies and seen these kind of films over the years. Now, after watching this film, watching it be made, and then watching it what I saw in the theater, like, I'm amazed. I just hope I could do a bunch more of these kind of films. I really do. It was a great experience, and the audience really liked the movie, you know?
Yeah,
and I think they're doing a great job with the commercials and all the trailers that they have. They have, like, 10 different kinds. I mean, they're really doing a great job promoting it. It's just great. It looks great all around. I'm very proud to be in this film.
Mm. It really does for an actor, though. We've discussed this before in the show. The technology gives actors more opportunities, different opportunities that obviously haven't previously existed. Does it feel like a whole new discipline, or does it just feel like a natural extension of what actors do normally?
You know, it's an extension. It's make-believe. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, it's make-believe, and that's what that is. You make-believe and there's a building. You make-believe and there's this. I mean, that's, if you've been around, and you know, basically you can understand what's going on in your mind. I mean, unless you're just a total airhead, you're not going to know if there's a building in front of you. You know what I'm saying? You're not going to know, I'm going to run into this building if I run straight. You know, it's all parameters of what you can and can't do anyway, whether you're on set or not. You know, when you're shooting a movie, whether, you know, you can't move 2 inches because you're out of the frame. You can't move 2 inches. It's almost that. You know, you have to make believe, and you imagine when you're shooting a regular film, it's the same as this, you know. And like I said, a good thing for Stu, because he helped me, because I had so many different roles to do. He would piece it together and let me see what I was doing. You know, I had a different kind of situation than most actors, just going in front of a green screen. Like, I was doing stuff like with myself over and he would let me see it. So, you know, he was just as much as a help to me as Frank was, you know, giving me the scenario.
Let me tell you too, it's, we're talking about like comedy timing performances here, where Louis is performing sometimes in a scene where there's two or three other copies of himself. Anything I could do to help seemed to me like not enough, because I honestly don't know how you do it, man. You're freaking hysterical on the screen, and
thanks,
and you're five times as hysterical when there's five of you on the screen. It would have been very easy for that not to work, and I think you did an amazing job.
Thank you, but I appreciate that, and same to you, man. When I saw this movie the other night, I was just floored. I was so impressed, and I had no idea what I was going into when I watched it, and I absolutely loved it.
But the look of the film, we might have touched upon this a little bit earlier, but Central City in the film, tell me about the creation of that. And I know you obviously had the comics to look back on, but were there any kind of film noirs out there that you guys referenced as well for that conception?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, a big one was the movie Naked City. Which was, kind of one of the first in what has become a cinematic tradition of kind of love letters to New York.
The Barry Fitzgerald one?
Is that right? Yeah. The
Tales from the Naked City, or?
Yeah. You know.
Okay. Yeah, I know. That's a great film.
Yeah. And that was kind of one of the early things for me, getting to visit Frank in New York. We took a walk through his neighborhood. He lives in Hell's Kitchen, you know, and we're walking around and we're looking at all these warehouses and water towers, and I got to kind of see New York through Frank's eyes, and he doesn't see the glass and steel. He sees things through a very kind of specific filter, and you see that in his in his artwork. You see it in his movies where, you know, someone might have a cell phone, but then they hop in a police car that's from the 50s, you know. He kind of filters through history and picks out the best best looking stuff, you know, and it creates this timeless world. It's really cool, and I got to just kind of get this little walking tour of Frank's neighborhood. And I'm a photographer, and I just took my camera with me, and I took endless photos, and I've been doing that forever. My first directing gig was a music video in New York, and I took a lot of location scout photos on rooftops, and so I was able to go through with Frank and show him some photography and show him images and just kind of, you know, he could put a red X or something saying, that's not Central City, that is, that's not, that is.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically learned through Frank that Central City, as viewed by Frank Miller, is basically New York seen with a very specific filter that just kind of takes out anything that isn't romantic.
Yeah.
I agree with you. That's the best way to put it, exactly.
Yeah.
100% right, Stu.
Thank you.
Is anything possible now in terms of visual effects, or are we on the cusp of another breakthrough?
Well, unfortunately, probably yes. Anything is possible, right? But it doesn't mean you should do it. I'm a big fan of Louis in a way. Like I kind of have this other side of my personality where I'm in the independent film world, and I'm oftentimes trying to do things on a budget, and I'm a big fan of restricting yourself and only doing what you can do well. So I'm actually the visual effects guy who is probably least interested in visual effects that you'll ever meet. I really don't care for the gigantic visual effects spectacle kind of stuff. There's a time and a place for it, and if it's used appropriately, it can be great. But there's so much that can be done with just traditional simple filmmaking. For me, I just don't see a barrier between, you know, traditional filmmaking. Just like Louis was saying, you know, an actor is dealing with all kinds of weird constraints about staying in the light, or, you know, just the very act of filming a conversation between two people is a special effect, you know, because you turn around, you shoot the other half of the conversation, the whole crew moves, the light moves, everything changes, but when the audience sees it, they view it as a seamless thing, just two people talking. To me, that's a visual effect, you know.
Yeah.
So the more things are possible, the more I think it still, to me, is the interesting challenge is just, well, how do you take the tools you have and make an emotional connection with the audience? And in this movie, it was never really about a big technical problem-solving thing. It was always just about how do we make something beautiful? How do we help, communicate Frank's love for the city? The city is really a character in the movie. To be able to provide something like that and to make images that are indelible and that kind of seem like they have that Frank Miller stamp on them, that's a huge artistic challenge. It makes all the technology in the world irrelevant if you can't just make something that looks pretty, you know?
Right. Louis, we've asked you questions about acting and discipline and that sort of thing. Now here's the most serious question of all I have for you. What was it like performing with such gorgeous women?
Really. How did you control yourself with Eva Mendes and Scarlett Johansson?
I would just look at Stu and get right back in control of myself.
I was a better man than I am.
This is who I'm really working with. And every time they were there, I would be like, you know, eyes peeled. But then when they turned around, I have to look at Stu to get my reality check again.
No offense to you, Stu, but the two of them really are the best visual effect in the movie.
Yeah, you know, I'm the visual equivalent of thinking about baseball, you know.
Right.
Uh-huh. You really just want to focus on your work.
Let me tell you something, that really is hot sometimes. Like, especially in that role, they were all dressed hot and beautiful, and they were all very nice.
That's,
I mean,
part of being the operative word.
No.
That's
but
the worst,
like,
part of it is that they're all so nice. And
right.
It was really
It was so nice, like, working with these good people. Like, these actors were great. It wasn't like anyone came in pretentious, annoying. You were looking at them, and it was almost like, you know, it was almost like their personalities overtook their looks, if that makes any sense.
It does.
You know, and it was almost like, wow, these guys are great. Hey, what's up? It wasn't like, hey, this girl's hot. I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, they are beautiful and gorgeous, and they're great to look at, but when you get to know someone, and they start to make you laugh, and they bust your balls, and they tell jokes, and they're not like, you know, they're not this person that everyone just looks at, but they're real people, so it almost relates to them, like, you know, they can almost be like one of your cousins or something, you know, what's up, and every time they come in, you have them laugh, and you almost forget how beautiful they are because they're so nice and cool with you, you know what I'm saying?
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, that's the truth, though. You know, everyone. Let me tell you, that whole entire film was like that, from Frank to the girls, to Stu, to Sam. I mean, you know, everyone's so successful in their path, and they, on this film, it was so unlike a Hollywood set, I have to tell you. It was more like, this is great. I couldn't wait to come back to work every day, you know?
Yeah.
That's a good environment.
Yeah.
That's the only shallow question I'll ask.
I mean, come on, Jamie. I mean,
I'm sure you can outdo yourself in shallowness. I'll just sit here and wait for you to ask another dumb question.
It's
the holidays. Why am I being so mean?
Yeah, why are
all right.
Lewis, come on, baby. We're friends.
You know I love you guys.
We love you too.
All right.
Tell me about it is a different style of performance, though, in this film. How would you describe that style? It's not naturalistic or... What is it? Kind of heightened, and what is that?
To me,
you refer to it. Yeah, Louis.
Like the performance of acting wise, or how it looked.
Yeah, no, how you modulate your performance. It looks a little, it's stylized. How would you describe that style of acting that this film required?
You know, it was almost like so characterish, but it's not over the top. You know what I'm saying? And I just looked at all the actors in the movie like that. It wasn't like over the top, but it was so character-y, you know? So it was, you know, it's almost like borderline of, you know, over the top and character-y. And I think the best person who did a fabulous job was Dan Lauria. He plays the cop in the movie, and when I speak for that, he reminds me of what I'm saying. Like, he was not over the top, but he was a great character. You know,
right.
He wasn't playing the normal guy, but he was very, very character-y, like you would say a foot away from being over the top, but 10 feet away from not, you know? And it made it work with all the characters, you know, with all of them. They all had that kind of feel in it, and I think, you know, it's like that's just a style I guess Frank was going for as a director, you know, and
yeah.
It worked. I thought it was great.
In the comic book, too, in the Spirit comic book, there is a certain kind of weird, I don't know, you know, like visual melodrama to it, you know, that the Spirit has always got kind of this befuddled look on his face, a little bit bug-eyed, you know, the
mm-hmm.
situations are always just a little bit out of his control, the women are impossibly beautiful, and I think Frank did a great job of directing the actors to kind of invoke that feeling that the comic book gives you, where the world is just a little bit pushed out into the realm of stylized, you know, like stage theatrical kind of performance, but you know, it's, man, that requires a subtle touch, and I think it does. Did an amazing job,
and I'm sure it doesn't come across over the top because it's in keeping with the reality of the film. I mean, none of these performances are outside of what the film is trying
to
convey.
Yeah, it's all very consistent,
convey.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It opens Christmas Day. Everyone's looking forward to it. I know Jerry and I are very much looking forward to it. What's next for you both? Stu, if you want to start, what's on the roster for you upcoming?
Well, you know, my day job tends to be directing commercials, and I've already jumped back into doing that. I directed some teen smoking PSAs that immediately got banned as soon as I finished them up. So
No kidding.
So I'm trying to continue that Frank Miller controversy thing. But you know, I mean, I can only hope to, you know, Frank's been talking about Sin City 2, and you know, I can only hope to work with him again. It would be such a blast. But I'm
Buck Rogers.
Back into my world of directing TV commercials right now.
Well, he's talking about Buck Rogers as
well.
Yeah,
what
he?
Is it about Buck Rogers that interests him so much?
Yeah, you know, I have no idea. I just saw that announcement, and that was brand new news to me. I gotta say, my mind is reeling imagining what he might do with that material. So,
exactly. I was just gonna say that too. I'm thinking, wow, poor Buck Rogers. Wow,
well, it's not going to be Gil Gerard, I take it. So
I hope to God I'm not Buck Rogers in that movie.
You just might wind up being Buck Rogers in that movie,
Lewis. This could be a big deal for you.
Yeah, I can't wait to see. You got to hire an actor you really don't like to play Buck Rogers in that movie. You know.
So what's upcoming for you, Louis?
You know what? I'm actually working on a documentary now about the school system and the problem with the kids today and, you know, kind of what happened with them in the last 20 years. And I'm leaving for Florida next month to start this.
Wow.
So this is something that's a really, real, like, you know, just the problem with the youth of today. It's like, what's the problem? You know, in 20 years from now, what's going to be the real problem if you don't straighten it out now? That's basically what I'm trying to figure out, and I'm doing it with like a lot of main people from the Florida school system, a lot of like, you know, people involved. So, you know, this is something that I'm just going to find time and I'm going to go do it whenever I can, like to start it immediately.
Oh, terrific. We got a couple of callers on the line. Let me take these real quick. We have 516 area code. 516, do you have a question?
Yeah. Hey, Louie, how you doing? This is Jesse from Long Island.
I was going to say, where in Long Island? I know that 516. where in Long Island you from?
I'm from Franklin Square. Well, I'm originally from Elmont, but I just
All right,
moved
yeah,
there.
I'm from the Bronx right there, right over the bridge.
Okay. first of all, big fan. Working on The Sopranos, you actually worked with my cousin. Wanted to know if you remembered him, Gary Perez.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my cousin.
Oh, wow, man. Small world. Call myself
hello. Yeah. I will. I just wanted to say, first of all, big fan. And I loved you in The Sopranos mostly. And you were funny as hell on Entourage. And
right.
I just want to know, who's the biggest, well, better yet, who's the best talent you ever worked with? Was it face-to-face screen time?
I would say, honestly, it would probably be Malcolm McDowell and Samuel Jackson.
Mm.
Yeah.
You've been better than that.
No, I worked with Malcolm McDowell for a year, every day. We did a show together in Hawaii. And let me tell you something, that was like 11 years ago. And he was one of my, like, that was almost like, this is how you learn how to act. We're not acting, but learning how to be professional and to be an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that helped me so much, especially when I did 24. Because a lot of dealing with Malcolm really helped me on 24, more than Sopranos, I should say.
Okay.
How did it apply to the 24 experience?
Because Malcolm is such a serious person on camera, but when you meet him off, he's not, you know. But he can translate that emotion in 1 second on camera, and you go, "Wow, this guy's so intense, or he's so this." But actually, he's not. He's really the most lovable person, nicest 5-year-old kid, you know. And I learned how to do like to show up and be a professional. You don't have to sit there being a teacup. He would always say, "It's acting. Just act." You know, every time somebody would try to take something serious, like an actor on the set, and I learned it is fun. Just act. It isn't so you know, it isn't like you're walking to a boiling lava. You know, it's fun, enjoy it, but you can still be serious on camera when you are enjoying it. And I think that helped me, like I said, with 24.
Mm. And what a great talent. And he's been around for so long, and he's had so many great collaborators. He's amazing. Thank you so much for calling in, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you guys.
And Stu, you take care and good luck with the film, and I hope I talk to you soon.
All right, take it.
All right, guys.
Okay, one more call, and then we'll close up here. 702 area code, if I can bring it up. 702, go right ahead.
Hello, geeks, and hello, Lewis.
Hey, bud.
Hey, what's up?
Hey. I know you've been in part of very many landmark series, but I was just wondering if you ever think that Fantasy Island will ever make it to the big screen.
Uh-oh. You know what happened? you know what happened somewhere in Vegas?
We lose Louis?
Yeah.
We lost Louis because when I said goodbye to the caller,
oh my
he thought
God.
I was saying goodbye to him.
Oh, my God.
Dude, you just ruined the joke.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, man.
Well, thank you for calling, man.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
Oh,
that's
okay. Terrible. All right. Well, Stu,
yeah.
thank you so much.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. If you want, I could probably try to answer any more questions that come in for him, but...
Okay.
The movie's called The Spirit. It opens up Christmas Day. And I will write to Louis and apologize to him. I'm so sorry for that. But, Stu, thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you the best of luck. And please come back to the show anytime you'd like.
Come back
it's
anytime.
It's my pleasure, guys. I'm a new fan of the show. It's great fun to be on, and as you can tell, Louis and I had a great time making this movie. I can't wait for you guys to see it.
Oh, likewise. I can't wait either.
We had a pleasure having you on. It was great.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Guys.
Bye-bye now.
Right.
Okay, that's Louis Lombardi and Stu Mashwitz. A couple of great guys. Hang on real quick. Louis, is this you?
Yeah, I thought I hung up on you.
Oh, my God, Louis's back. Oh, my God.
I'm on the phone. I just keep calling. No, I thought I hung up on you. I'm like, let me call these guys. Did I hang up on you by accident?
No, what it was, I said thanks for calling to the caller, and I guess you thought I was saying goodbye to you.
Yeah, I was like, wow, that was abrupt, huh? All right.
Yeah.
I hung up.
Hey, we want you on, Louie. We don't want you to hang up. You know?
You got a chair for me there. Can I come hang out on the set with you guys and just hang around?
Exactly.
You got to hang out. Yeah, definitely.
Where are you guys? Where are you guys located?
We're in two separate locations, actually. James is in Florida, and I'm in Maryland.
Oh, all right. Well, how come I'm down with a 718 number? Is this like a back cave?
It's the miracle of the internet.
All right, I'm just checking. Well, if you guys ever want me to come down and be a guest host, I'd love to host the whole show.
Oh, you are a fellow movie geek, my friend.
Yeah, I love it. You kidding me? And let's see what we got going on. You guys have a happy holidays, man. If you guys
you,
ever
you
want
too.
To back,
would you, yeah. would you mind taking a call real quick? This
yeah.
gentleman called. Okay.
Go ahead. Let's talk.
Hang on real quick. This is 702 area code. All right, Mark. Go ahead, man.
Okay. I'll be quick, Louie, but I wanted to ask you, you're part of so many landmark series like The Sopranos and 24, but do you ever think that Fantasy Island will ever make a movie?
You know what? They are. They actually are. It's funny you say that. I read about it about a year ago that they're going to make the film, you know?
Wow.
It's pretty interesting. Yeah, you would think after the second series bombed so bad that they would, but they're actually doing it, you know. And that was a great job I had. That was a lot of special effects stuff I did, too, on that movie. But it was nothing like The Spirit. I mean, compared to 10 years ago, think about how much we've moved on, you know.
Right. It can really be a Fantasy Island now.
Right. Are you in Vegas? Hey, 702, are you in Vegas?
Yeah.
All right, that's how they announce you people. 516-702. You know what Stan, you know
hey,
what
that's
Stan,
how we do it here, man.
I love it. You know what the saddest part
is? His house.
As I know every single area code you throw out. I love it. That shows you I've been a lot of places.
People are just an area code to us, really.
I know. That's horrible. I was going to say that. Am I just like a 310?
No, dude, you're our brother, man. Come on, we wouldn't say that about you.
That's what I like to hear, guys. You know I love you guys.
Thank you so much, Louie, and please come back.
Thank you, and happy holidays, Louie.
You too, guys. Happy holidays, man. And check out The Spirit, and I hope you guys love it and enjoy it. And call me back. I'll tell you more about it when you see it.
All right.
Thank you, my friend.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. All right, Louie Lombardi.
Dude, now that was great. We had a good time with those guys. That was a good interview.
And thank you, 702, for calling back in. See that I can't call
yeah,
by his
thank
name.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All righty. We're ready for our next segment. And I got to figure out which phone number is our next segment.
Oh, hell.
Yeah. Well, let's just play it by ear here. We're really excited to welcome our next guest to the show.
A BTR luminary.
That's right. He's a legend in the BTR universe. His Radio Happy Hour will be celebrating their best show moments of 2008 with a two-part special airing this Tuesday and next Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern, and we're going to give you a little taste of a really high-profile interview that's going to be included on that show this upcoming Tuesday. Really excited to welcome him to the show. He's a great host, a great personality, and I hate to build him up this much, but he's worth it. please welcome to the show, Dr. Blogstein. Doctor, are you on the line?
Doctor's on the line.
All right, doctor.
That was the best introduction ever.
Thank you.
I find that hard to believe. I know
no,
that you get...
It really is. I got to... When you do introductions, but whenever you introduce a segment, you can tell the passion that you speak with.
I have tremendous passion for you, Dr. Blogstein.
Well,
it's
the feeling is
Doc,
mutual.
We love you on this show, so...
Let's explore my passion for you, Dr. Blogstein.
Let's not go too deep into that, please.
Yeah, let's really not, Jamie.
I just
think...
Tell me about your show, how you got it started, and the kind of personality of your show.
Well, the idea behind the show is you troll around the internet, you realize that there are tons and tons and tons of people with no friends.
Did it take you to make that analysis?
Right away.
Yeah, it doesn't take long.
So I wanted... to provide a venue to those people where, you know, once a week for an hour, hour and a half, we will be your friends.
Mm.
Well, that's a very generous offer.
And not only will we be your friends, but we'll introduce you to famous people, we'll entertain you, we'll allow you to participate.
You know, when you do that, when you kind of court the lonely souls out there, as you're discussing, there's a danger of producing stalkers. Do you have any super fans that frighten you at all?
Well, you know what? aside from Jamie, now that I realize there's passion involved there, but no, I must have really, really good stalkers, because the best stalkers you don't know until they kill you.
That's right.
But
that's
you don't
right.
Recognize
and
that they're there. So that,
and
if
you're still,
I do,
you're still breathing. So that's
yeah. I mean, you're doing all right.
Exactly. And I would only ask that if I do have a stalker and they do decide to, you know, kill me, do it while I'm on the air, because that would be really good.
Be good for ratings.
That'd be great. We'll promote that on the show too.
Yeah.
So tell me about your favorite moments from the year. A couple of them, since we're looking at a two-parter from you looking back. What sticks out for you?
You know, what sticks out for me are the moments from the show that A, weren't planned, B, didn't involve a guest, they just happened to materialize. And more often than not, they just come from people calling in and being those weird, friendless people that populate the internet. I mean, people call in with ridiculous things to talk about, and I give them a venue, and I like to participate in those conversations. So those are my favorite ones are the ones that are not planned. The moments
right.
that are not planned, and the moments that really have nothing to do with what the show is going to be about.
Yeah, and your show is such that it really inspires a kind of very entertaining lunacy in a way. So it allows for a lot of those spontaneous moments.
Yeah, I love that. I like to think of myself not as a host, but as a ringleader.
Exactly. You're the Jerry Springer of talk radio.
Oh. But okay.
So you interviewed, and this is a little clip we're going to be playing, and this airs this Tuesday, right, at 9 p.m. Eastern?
Not only does it airs this Tuesday, 9 p.m. Eastern, but this is the this is actually an interview that is unique to the Best Of. In other words, it's never been played on any other show. This is actual new material that I am unveiling on a Best Of episode. You know how, like, Billy Joel would do one new song on his greatest hits? That's what
right.
I'm doing.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's play this. This is exceptional. You got to speak to a genuine cinematic icon, and you guys are going to enjoy this. Listen to this clip.
Dr. Martin.
Hollywood legend. Ernest Borgnine.
Call me Ernie, B, by all means.
I can call you Ernie?
Sure.
Wow.
That's the name.
All right, Ernie. it is an honor to have you on the Radio Happy Hour.
Well, bless your heart, Dave. God bless you. That's wonderful.
How does it make you feel to be called a legend?
I always have to think a little bit about that because I'm not a legend yet. I'm still working.
Oh, that's okay.
You know, and how can you be a legend if you're working?
Because you're still building your legendary status.
Absolutely, still working, and I just finished a picture of my 200th film. About 4 weeks ago.
No, congratulations, 200.
Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah, and I tell you, it was wonderful because, and I was also working with a girl. But what the hell's her name? Her name is Ladd. And would you believe that about 40, maybe 40, 42 years ago, I was working with her grandfather,
oh my
Alan
goodness.
Ladd.
Wow.
So you see, never give up, never give up.
Yeah, so why are you still working at 91 when most people would just be living in Florida?
Well, I tell you, you know, this is what keeps you going. I'll be 92 in January 24th. And I still look forward to going to work, because to me, this is my, I don't know, it gives me a whole new incentive on life. And by keeping busy, this is what keeps you young.
Are you still happy with the kinds of parts that you're getting, or
no.
you're not happy?
No.
Because
no.
you're getting old man parts, right?
Well, it's not the idea of old man parts. It's just the idea that, you know, there's nobody writing anything for older people. You know?
Yeah.
We have all this young stuff today on television, and they're making love and everything else, and they don't even know what the hell love is. You know? They're smooching up a storm, and they don't know what the hell it's all about. It's silly. Not that I'm any great authority on this whole deal, but you know, I don't know. It just doesn't make sense anymore. In my day, we had people. Robert Taylor. You believed Robert Taylor because he was a grown man. He was and all those wonderful people that he worked with, all those wonderful women that he made love to. You understood that. That to me made sense. You know, when he was working with Greta Garbo in that wonderful picture, Camille, or what the hell you want to call it. You understood that they were older people who knew what love was all about. Today, they try to remake the film with these young kids who don't know what the hell it's all about.
So you're saying that in movies today there's no romance, and they're just you can't understand why they're jumping into bed with each other.
Two bodies coming together and never knowing what the hell it's all about.
So if they were to write a good script with a love story, would you still play a love story part?
Hey, listen, if they could see me as a love story, believe me, I'd do it.
Here on the radio, happy hour.
Now that was awesome. That was
that's going to be a great interview.
Yeah, he is such a nice, gracious man. He is going to be 92, and he's still sharp as a tack. And
yeah,
you can tell why he's still alive at 92 and still vibrant. In fact, last night on the Hallmark Channel, don't ask me why I was watching it, but his,
I won't ask.
There was a movie with him, Grandpa for Christmas, something like that. But and there's a reason, because when you listen to this interview, he's always laughing and joking around. He's just
mm-hmm,
a jovial
mm-hmm.
guy. He's happy.
But he's been mm-hmm. in some of the greatest, I mean, From Here to Eternity and especially The Wild Bunch. He's William Holden's best friend, Dutch. I mean, dude, he's an incredible actor. I mean, and you know, regardless, and there's a lot of sad truth in what he said in that segment we just heard.
Yeah.
Beautiful stuff. Good stuff, Doctor.
Thank
it's
you.
Really, and where else can you hear Ernest Borgnine talk about his old man parts? So I think...
Yeah, I mean, really. Never mind. But
it's a can't-lose situation here. So you've got to tune in.
That's a
Tuesday.
Great interview, my friend.
Oh,
it
thank
really
you.
Is.
And it's really good. He gave me so much time, so it's really a full interview. He goes into politics. He goes into more of what it used to be like, back in my day stuff.
Right.
He tells a very, very funny story about what the – because he wrote an autobiography. It's called Ernie, but he tells
right.
a very funny story of what he wanted the book to be called.
Oh, okay. I'm
well,
very curious.
Save it for a surprise for the
yeah,
show.
Yeah, I'm very curious.
In the business, we call that a tease.
Exactly. And he has so much life and humor about him. I saw him a couple of months ago when this book first came out, or last month. He was on a morning news show, and they asked him, "What keeps you going?" or something to that effect. And he whispered to the co-anchor, he said, "I masturbate a lot."
I do ask him about that, too.
Oh, great, great.
Oh, good for you. All right. I mean, he's the original McHale's Navy, not Tom Arnold. I mean, come on.
Exactly. Tell me from one interviewer to another.
Yep.
We're both highly professional.
Unbelievably professional.
Yeah. Tell me about your style. And did you have it right away, or did it kind of come to you, and what is that style when you interview people?
I try my hardest to speak to people as though they're my equals, even though they are far above me. I don't like to sound like I am starstruck when most of the time I am. I like
right.
to have it be just a normal everyday conversation. And you know what? A lot of, it's a really good opportunity. I'm sure you feel this way too, where you probably have questions about things or people or movies or directors that you have always wondered, and here you have this opportunity to ask, you know, get the answer straight from the horse's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually like to get answers about things that I've been curious about, ask questions about what I think everyone wants to know about, and kind of show a relaxed, fun side. I like to joke around with. It's nice to showcase people's sense of humor.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's very special what you do too, because obviously when most guests come on our show, it's for a specific reason to promote a movie that opens that week or what have you. So our conversations tend to revolve around that. You actually get a real good sense of who these people are on your show just by the kind of off the cuff conversing. You have a very natural way about how you speak to people, and you're a natural, my friend.
Thank you. The thing is, we have two different shows, both quality.
Right.
You could have Ernest Borgnine on your show tomorrow, and it would be an amazing interview, but it would be really, really different because I don't know films and the industry like the back.
But
of my
I
head.
Would ask Ernest Borgnine this one question: if you want to punch out Jonathan Silverman when he did that show that Jonathan Silverman, that sitcom he did in the mid-90s?
Yeah, single guy?
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, that's it. Did he want to punch him out?
You know what? Can you believe that Ernest Borgnine played, like, what was he, a doorman on a stupid sitcom?
It was embarrassing because this guy was in the Wild Bunch, and he says, I'll bring the paella.
Do you do a lot of research, man? Like, obviously, he had a book out. Did you read the book? Did you look back through the movies? What's the extent of the research that you do?
Yeah, I do. I do a lot of research because I like. I read the book. A lot of online stuff. Didn't go back to watch any of the movies, but I like to know. I like to surprise. You know, because a lot of these stars, for lack of a better word. Go on these shows, and they're given like 3 minutes, and the interviewer, whatever show it is, they don't know much about anything except for the talking points that the publicist gives you. So I like to surprise people with the knowledge that I have about them.
And tell us the website again. Tell us our listeners the website. We'll post it up.
Oh, cool. Go to www. Dr. Blockstein, that's drblogstein.com.
MOUSC, all right.
drblockstein.com. This Tuesday night and then the following Tuesday night, the Best of Part 1, Part 2 become available. And you know what? I would venture to guess that a lot of the people that listen to this show haven't heard my show. So give it a shot. If you're going to try it out.
It's a good show, folks.
Give it a try. Try it out. I guarantee you, you'll hear the best of the part one. You'll want to hear part two, and believe it or not, every week is a best of. So
exactly.
That's the right way. You're absolutely right, my friend.
It was impossible to cut up these shows from the past year because every week is so good.
Yeah. Tell me, I don't want you to give away any trade secrets or anything, but. Dr. Blockstein, where does that come from?
I need it. It was just.
Man, you're putting him on the spot, Jamie. Come
on. I'm trying to tell this story.
Are you really an MD?
I'm trying to tell it in as interesting a way as possible because it's really such a stupid, lame ass story. But I needed to post a picture on the internet so I can embed it into a long story. So I just wanted to start a free website. I went to blogspot.com to, you know, you could get free websites on there. So I was just putting in stupid things like bloggity blog, but that was taken, and blockity, whatever. I was putting in stupid words. Dr. Blockstein was the next one that came up, and it worked, and I put it in there, and I loaded up the picture. I did what I needed to do. And then I started, you know what, I have a blog. Maybe I should try writing stuff. And one thing led to another. People started reading it, and
do you feel at all like you're misleading people into thinking that you're an MD?
Yes. You know what? That's my biggest regret is that I don't use my real name on the show.
I was going to ask you to cure my right arm, but okay.
Well, I can help you there. Pull down your pants.
No, that's the problem.
He's been doing what Ernest Borgnine does a lot. It's made his art very sore.
Yeah, my only regret is that people see that dopey picture that I have in the logo, and I can't change it now because now it's synonymous with the show. But people
think, right.
people might think that I'm a big dork, but I'm really not that dork.
You're not. They don't say that about you. Not as far as you know.
I would not feel the amount of passion I do towards you if you're a big dork.
Yeah, you're not a dork. Not at all, my friend.
Thank you.
All right, my friend. Hey, we want you to come back and be on a roundtable, and I meant to discuss this with you. We might as well do it on the air. We have a couple of ideas for roundtables, and we would love you to be a part of it. One of them is a roundtable on adult cinema.
Oh.
Are you any kind of connoisseur of adult cinema?
I actually am a connoisseur. I was watching some last night.
Yeah. Every 5 minutes. Look, I set an engagement ring to Chasey Lane. Never heard anything back.
I was watching a new movie called 7 Pounds, and it wasn't the one with Will Smith. So it was a very good one.
What the fuck was your 7 Pounds?
I'll send you the link, Jerry.
Send me the link, goddammit.
Okay. Anyway, we have awards, roundtables, and things. We would love for you to come back on.
Yeah, Doc, you're welcome anytime you want to come on.
Oh,
we enjoy you very much.
I love the show. First, I mean, I'm a fan of the show, so it's cool to be on, and I would love to come back.
We're delighted to have you on anytime.
All right, Dr. Blogstein, Tuesday night, this Tuesday, the 23rd, next Tuesday, the 30th, 9 p.m. Eastern. Don't miss it. We urge all of our listeners out there to catch this. It's a great big party. It's a great, great entertaining show. Dr. Blogstein, thank you so much, man.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity
to
your listeners. Thank you.
Anytime,
buddy. Bye-bye now.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
You too, man. You too. Dr. Blogstein, listen to a show. It's fantastic, and you got to hear a little piece of that Ernie Borgnine interview. So that's
you really have to tell me about this version of 7 Pounds you watched.
You haven't seen anything with midgets before? It's great. It's good stuff.
Oh, man, that's nasty. All right, never mind.
We're going to close out the show on this note. A great film is currently in release, and it's also on IFC On Demand. It's called Where God Left His Shoes, and if you read any reviews of this film, you won't miss the fact that this is a shining moment in John Leguizamo's career, and he's a terrific actor already, but this is a great, great performance. It's about a family struggling through poverty and homelessness and unemployment in New York City during the holiday season. And it's a great film, and I recommend you see it. And it's very moving, but not in a sad way. I mean, it won't make you depressed.
Okay, that's good to know. That's very good to know.
And this interview will illuminate some of those qualities that make it an uplifting, but at the same time, very realistic, naturalistic experience. This is Sal Stable. He's kind of a wonder kind. He made a short film, or he made a feature-length film, I believe, very cheaply, something like $10,000. It was a wacky movie that actually got the attention of people like Steven Spielberg and Oliver Stone, and got him deals with Spielberg, I believe, and Oliver Stone introduced it at a screening one time. They were very taken by him. And it was a long journey to get this Where God Left His Shoes written, but not very long to get it financed. And it's a very interesting story. So here's Sal Stable speaking about Where God Left His Shoes. I read somewhere that this is a quote from you. You're dedicated to making films about the challenges of everyday life and people faced with difficult, life-changing economic and moral decisions. And Where God Left His Shoes certainly falls in that category. I'm wondering, where do you think that comes from, that drive to tell these stories?
I'd say it probably comes from where I was raised, how I was raised, and my experiences in life. I grew up in Brooklyn, and, you know, middle-class family, and just saw the values that we shared and kind of the hardships that everybody endured. And you know, it's. I think that's probably where it comes from.
Yeah, yeah. What really strikes me about the film is the family that's portrayed in the film, and they always stick together through everything, and that's their strength, that's their bond, and what gets them through Was that something that you saw reflected in your own family that you wanted to express?
Yes, absolutely. Growing up, I mean, when you don't have much and you don't have the material possessions that I think people today aspire to have, you know, when I grew up, we really just had each other. We didn't have a million gadgets or video games or, you know, we had a TV and we had us. And
right.
No matter how much, you know, difficulty kind of came into our lives or whatever, we were always there for each other, brothers, sisters, mother, father, cousins, family, and we all kind of supported ourselves. So
mm-hmm.
when I've been a writer for some time, and I always look for inspiration. And I remember, thinking about just how I grew up and, you know, having the family support from childhood into adulthood. And I said, to me, that's the most important thing that, you know, as I begin to, you know, have children and marriage and the most important thing is that as long as you have family, you're going to be okay. And that was kind of the initial inspiration of the film, and I wanted to get that across. And that's why I kind of ended the film where it was. Even though they don't have anything, I felt like their love for each other is more than most have.
Yes, yeah. And you mentioned writing, and you actually, you didn't want to be a director, if I understand correctly, at first. You were focused on writing. What turned the tide for you? What made you decide you wanted to direct as well?
When I was in college, and I guess the last couple of years of high school, I just began to, you know, study literature and just have a real passion for it. And I went to school for screenwriting, and I had met some people within the film program who basically said, you know, in order to become a screenwriter, you'd have to, you know, there's two avenues. And one avenue was making your own film, an independent film. And so I'm going back 15 years, I'd say. I was 19 years old. I was in film school. There was no video. You had to cut film on a Steam Deck, which I did with my first movie. And I had $10,000 to continue my education for my sophomore year of college, and I decided instead just to put it into the film. And so it was more of a way for me to get into the industry as a writer and showcase my talent as a writer.
Right.
And
right.
I adopted the directing seat at a very young age. And I kind of stayed away from it, you know, since I did the first one, just because I just have such a passion for writing, and it's so much easier and I guess more productive for me to write 4 or 5 scripts, whether it's film or TV, a year. Whereas with a movie, you know, once you get in bed with the film, it's 2 to 3 years of your life.
Right, right. But it does fascinate me, and I admire people that like to write and are good at it very much, in that there are two totally different kind of environments that you create for yourself, it would seem, on the outside, because writing would seem very solitary, and then, of course, directing is the ultimate kind of collaborative effort. Do both of those satisfy something in you? Do you feel like you need both of those now?
Yeah, I definitely. I think now more than ever, there's something about creating a vision and a part of you. And every script that I write, I kind of try to find a piece of myself, and it's a very private, solitary kind of thing. Because I think, you know, if you're going to make it in the business over time, you're going to get to maybe direct, you know, 5 or 10 movies if you're extremely lucky. And so why not have those films be something that's a personal reflection of you, even if the story is some, you know, big, elaborate Hollywood film or a very personal, small, independent film. Whatever it is, you have to find some kind of personal connection. And so writing from the outset allows you to make that personal connection. And then seeing it through as a director is more of, I find it a relief, because you do get to interact with people and you do get to allow everyone else in your cast and crew to envision the film for themselves, and then it becomes something greater than you ever did. And on this film, you know, I, as a writer, you have this desire to, you know, tell this great story. And then once you put somebody like John Leguizamo on the lead, and I had a great cinematographer and, you know, great production designers and great producers, and they all just kind of take their jobs and do it amazingly, then the movie becomes something better. And that's the process I love to see happen. And, you know, like I said, my cast and crew, really, it, the film is as much as it is mine. It's theirs.
And how? Tell me about that process. How did this film become more than you had imagined when you're sitting there and writing it? And what do you see when you look at it? How did it become more than that for you?
Well, when you write it, you have this image in your mind, and then you have to actually go find the practical locations and the, you know, you're talking color temperature with your, you know, cinematographer, and you're talking the type of acting with your actors. And so for me personally, John Leguizamo, he took this film, and, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, a lot of Italian, we watch a lot of Italian neorealism films and talked about acting today, and really kind of wanted to go back to a time where there's this kind of sense of neorealism. And I guess that connects with my desire to, you know, talk about social issues and, you know, the plight of the common man and the struggles that they have. And so connecting with John on that level and watching him pull it off, it was really natural for him. I've seen him, I watched every one of his films and pointed out moments to him and talked about them and really just after, you know, we kind of discussed the whole film and what I was looking for, when we got on set, I didn't direct him. I let him do – our agreement was you could do whatever you want to do on the first take. The second take, you could fix whatever, you know, you want to fix. On the third take, if I feel there's some adjustment, I'll kind of give you my notes and my thoughts. And from there, if it's still not working, we do it as scripted and, you know, and we see what works in the editing room. And we never really had to get to that last process because John's originality, every take he did something – you know, that was really unexpected, and the bravery that he had to kind of show up and provide to the, you know, his cast every day. He was acting with, you know, an 8-year-old boy at the time. I think it was maybe 9. And so that's a tough chore. And that's, like I said, that takes a lot of bravery for an actor because you get a great piece of material, and then you're only as good as the people around you. And if you watch the film, personally, I think the kid is, David Castro is brilliant.
Amazing.
Yeah. That, I think, is a direct result of John's personal intervention and taking him under his wing and really talking to him, you know, because John has that mind of an actor, and I don't have that mind. I could talk to John on an adult level about where and how I'd like the film to turn out, but then he really provided that translation to the young boy. And although I'd love to take credit for his performance, I think it's brilliant. I think
it
David is just a natural talent, and then John just helped him rose to a level that, you know, was really completely unexpected. Nobody thought it would be that good. So
tell me, and Mr. Leguizamo is just, he is stunning in this movie. Tell me where that idea came from that you wanted him for the part, and did you have to pursue him for a long time, or did he kind of get the script right away?
You know, it's so funny because the film itself came along quickly, and, you know, people ask me, between my first film and this film, it was probably like 8 or 9 years before I got behind the camera again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, It took me 8 years to write this movie, even though it only took me, you know, 2 months to write it, you know. So the process with John and how the film was made was really the easiest I think I'll ever experience, and probably the easiest most independent writers, directors, producers will ever experience, because I had written the script in 2005, and within weeks somebody had presented the film to Vulcan Productions. And they had called me and met with me and basically said they would love to make the film. So we had the financing, which I've never, you know, I've gone out with other films that have taken 6 months to a year and then just failed and couldn't get, you know, the film going.
Right.
This was a situation where I had basically written the film and then turned it into the first financier that we were considering, and they came out and said, we want to do this, and, you know, who is your list of people? And so basically, the agents that I know kind of provided lists of people, and we just kind of went through them, and we made a very, very short list. I think it was maybe 3 to 5 people of people who were interested in doing independent films, who weren't concerned about how much money they're making or the quality of the set. Because, I mean, we knew it was going to be a rough production. We made the film for nothing. And John's name was first on the list, and we said, you know, let's go and make him an offer, which was nothing. And, you know, his agent said he loved the piece of material for him, and I think that's the best way for an independent, you know, writer, director, producer, or anybody who's trying to get an actor of, you know, of quality. The most important thing is when you have that piece of writing that's, that really just works on the page, the, you know, agents really do champion great work, because that's their job. Their job is to find their actors, you know, great work. And the people who handle John, you know, rushed it to him immediately. And I believe it was probably 2 weeks or so. John had requested a conversation, a meeting with me. And about a week after that, we sat down, we met. And we just had so much in common. You know, I'm from Brooklyn and grew up in New York all my life. And, you know, he's from Queens. And so we just had fundamentally a lot of the same points of view on filmmaking. And the great thing about John is, like myself, I mean, I watch probably a movie or two a night. His catalog of, you know, films and you know, what he can call upon is so much greater than any actor I've ever met. I mean, he tells me, you know, films that I've never even heard of knew existed, you know, from 40s, 50s, 60s, and I mean, I have to find them in the craziest ways. But he's, you know, he's a cinephile. He knows what he's doing and has the education behind him. So
something else that impresses me too, and it's in his performance and everyone's performance, and just in the marrow of the film, is that it's extremely moving. I mean, I was sitting here watching it the other night, just weeping. But it's not. There's no sentimentalizing going on. There's none of that. I mean, it feels authentic. Was that a major goal for you when you were preparing this?
It was actually the one obstacle that was presented to me right up front. The financiers came to me and they said, on the paper, this has the ability to become really sentimental, really schmaltzy. We don't want to see that. And luckily, you know, my first film, which had no sentimentality and no air of humanity or emotion, you know, I basically said, look, you know, this is on some level who I am. I don't really think as a human being that I can ever reach a level of emotion, you know, of where it could become sentimental. I'm just not that person. And, I showed them Bicycle Thief and, you know, we talked about, like, you know, other Italian neorealistic films like, you know, Rocco and His Brothers and Eve Vitaloni, and just a lot of things that I found in certain movies that I kind of loved the way they were handled, because they were portrayed in a real, fundamental way that, you know, didn't become sentimental. And I think Hollywood is very associated with, you know, sentimentality, because they never want you to leave the audience, you know, with an unanswered questions or feel, you know, that something wasn't resolved. And, you know, at the end of, if you read the end of the script, you know, for the first time, I mean, the movie is completely, you know, in a conventional sense, totally unresolved.
Yeah.
However, I feel differently, you know, and I felt it's the only real resolution that could have existed, you know, being in the situation that they were in.
Yeah, the ending of the film is precisely what that film is about, I found. So I thought the ending of it was just wonderful.
I actually wrote the ending. I wrote the ending before I wrote anything else. I said, because I thought actually I was going to begin the film there, and I just said, there's this beautiful moment I have, you know, with this family at this point.
Yeah.
And I just wrote it down, and I just kept, you know, backlogging and going, okay, how did they get there? What's their backstory? What happened the day before? What happened the month before? And then that became the film. So the ending was initially my beginning. And, you know, I think both journeys, you know, whatever film I had made, if you start from there and then follow their journey from there, it would have been equally as, you know, emotional and interesting. But I'm glad that we went the way we went.
Oh, it's perfect. I'm wondering, because the audience reaction when this finally comes to life and begins a new birth, so to speak, and you show it for audiences, as you have, I know it premiered at Tribeca and it's played here and there. Tell me about that audience reaction and what that was and how satisfying that was to you.
I don't know any director that has perspective on their films after they make them. I think somewhere between reading the script, going into pre-production, and then actually going on set, it all becomes a big blur. And then you get into the editing room, and you go, okay, like you begin to see the performance that works and the performance that doesn't, and you kind of piece the whole film together, and you know, build up with effects and music, and then you come out of this hole, you know, a few months after you cut the film, and you're just like, you don't know if it works as a movie. And I don't know any director that sits in the editing room and goes, this works, this is amazing, you know, the audience is going to love it. And so when we finished the film, we had done very, very little testing because it was a very personal film, and we all agreed that what was in there and the contents and the images and how it played were satisfactory to all of us, to the producers. And I invited John in to the editing process. I'm very, very collaborative because I'm very comfortable in the editing room. When I had made my first movie, I had cut the film from scratch, bare hands, you know, in my apartment on an A-plate. And so I learned editing from a very fundamental point of view. But I very early on, I recognized that you lose perspective very, very quickly. And if you don't have great filmmakers coming in, basically trashing your work as you sit there, your film suffers. And right. I was lucky enough on my first project to have, actually there was one director who I was very grateful for, a guy named Gary Winnick, who's fantastic. He's gone on to do a lot of great films since then. But at the time, he had just made a movie called Sweet Nothing with Michael Imperioli and Mira Sorvino. And Gary also directed Tadpole, and I mean, now he's directing big Hollywood films. But he came in the editing room and, you know, gave me a lesson, you know, film 101, you know, about cinema. And so getting back to your question, through the whole process, I had invited John and the filmmakers and a lot of different people to come see it, but didn't really test the film. So when it got to Tribeca, I didn't know what to expect. And we really, it was kind of a nerve-wracking experience. The first audience we showed it to were pretty much friends and family because everybody in New York came out to see it. And so, you know, after that, they were like, this is amazing. There were some people crying. And I didn't really, I took that at face value. It's like family, friends. No one's going to tell you it's terrible.
Right.
So I went to subsequent screenings where I knew absolutely nobody. And people were really crying. And I'm just like, wow, like this works. And then another thing happened. After the film, I happened to be there for question and answers, and basically people come up to me and go, look, this is such a powerful movie. Have you ever thought about, you know, associating with some sort of charity? Is there something we could do, donate money? Because they found out along the way while I was making the movie, we didn't have enough money at least I didn't think we were going to have enough money to make it on the budget we had. So I asked people to donate clothes, furniture. And then I told them, I said, listen, I'm going to use it for my sets. I'm going to use it to dress some extras. And then beyond that, I'm just going to turn everything over to, you know, Goodwill or a homeless charity. And what happened was I sent out an email to like 50 people I knew in New York who would be willing to send some clothes and some furniture or whatever. And that email kept being sent to other people. And then by the end of the film, we had a warehouse full of clothes, furniture. People had started sending food. Some people sent gift cards to like Kmart and Target, Walmart, and it became a charity that we didn't expect. And from there to now, you know, Vulcan Productions teamed up with those people who contacted us very early on. And since then, we've actually raised up to this point over $1 million for homeless charities all around the country. And I went to speak. Vulcan presented things, and Every dollar went to the charity who organized it, and we showed the film. At one event in Seattle, I spoke at an event, and it ended up raising like $492,000 for a charity up in Seattle. Mm. So the film is, you know, I personally feel it's a success artistically, but I also think the greater success is that it became something more than a film and actually helped people. So.
Yeah. I think so, too, and I thought of that as I was watching it. That's staggering what you've just said, but it's such a beautiful movie, and I think it can it's one of those movies that do have the power to make a difference in people's lives, whether it's just altering their perception just a little bit or inspiring them to give more of themselves to those that are less fortunate. And that's extremely, profoundly beautiful. And
when we set out, we never meant to make a movie about homelessness or we really, the movie is essentially about a family. You know, we never really decided to, you know, we weren't making a topical film to help raise money for anything, but the fact that it happened, and we have a great film out of it, it's amazing.
That's a wonderful film. And Sal, thank you so much for talking to us about it tonight, and please come back anytime you want in the future.
Oh, thank you for having me, and I'll take you up on that.
All right, my friend. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Okay, Where God Left His Shoes, you can order it, actually, IFC On Demand, if it's not playing at a theater near you. It's well worth it.
That was a great interview. Really, well done.
He was very nice, and he's made a great film. We want to wish everyone a happy holiday.
Definitely. All of you. And everyone.
Exactly. And to celebrate the holiday and give you guys the best wishes possible, Jerry has agreed to sing Silent Night. Go ahead, Jerry.
Wouldn't it be best if I just, like, didn't say anything?
That's a silent night.
There you go, baby.
All right, guys. We'll be back next week. Next week, we got a good show. It's our Sundance.
We got a big show.
Yeah, Sundance is going to be off the chain this year.
Yeah, we talked about that earlier this month. We talked about the lineup, and it's going to be a very interesting festival this year.
So we've got an interesting film. It's a documentary that tells the story of a boy's mental illness through childhood into adulthood, leading up to his demise from mental illness. And it's a documentary made by that boy's mother. So she'll be on the show. Her name is Dana Hines Perry. The film is called Boy Interrupted, and a narrative film that's in competition called Big Fan, and it co-stars Kevin Corrigan. And Kevin Corrigan.
He's the man. He's worked with some greats.
Yeah, yeah. The Departed, and he's worked with Scorsese a couple of times, and just a great bunch of films. Look him up, definitely. He'll be on next week as well. That'll be our Sundance show, and then look to January. We'll have our best and worst of 2008, and I'm way ahead this year, man, in seeing movies. Unlike previous years. I've actually seen...
You've seen some really good movies. You saw Slumdog Millionaire.
I saw Slumdog Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
I was blown away by it. And by the next morning, I had the lead actress in Slumdog Millionaire. agreeing to be on the show. So.
Are excellent.
It's a great movie, man.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And I wouldn't be disappointed at all if it won a host.
No, I would think, given the events in the last couple months, and I'm actually all for if it is nominated in Best Picture, it should win.
And the cinematography alone in that film, staggering.
Oh, yeah.
And the soundtrack, just staggering.
Absolutely.
Such incredible colors and the Dutch angles, and it's very stylized, and
mm-hmm.
it tells a very specific story, and I didn't feel like I had seen that movie before. And
let's put it like this: it's Charles Dickens for the 21st century, and I'll be very honest, you know, it's a lot better than the Roman Polanski version of Oliver Twist. There's no doubt about that, and it's a very original film from Danny Boyle, and I think hopefully, you know, he can get some recognition this year because he's a very versatile filmmaker.
He really is. Yeah, very much so. And then I saw 7 Pounds, and I think it's safe to say that won't be.
I don't think
favorite.
That will be anywhere, but I do think if Best Performance by Jellyfish, the film deserves an award.
Yeah, I'm sure PETA will give it an award. but there's nothing wrong with the performances, actually, in that film. It's very well performed.
I actually have to say, and I like Will Smith a lot, but I think it might be his weakest performance.
Oh, I thought he was great.
I like him, but I just think that compared to his previous films, I thought this was. I mean, he still makes it look. He when the camera's on him, you're fixated on him, but for his performances, though, I have to say this is like a lesser Will Smith compared to other films I've seen him in. That's not to
I
say
never,
he's
I
bad.
Never felt that. I never felt that way. I felt that it was a lesser movie in his canon.
It is a lesser film. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, but he carried. He grounded it in as much reality.
Yeah, but
as,
you're fixated,
as a ridiculous movie can stand.
Yeah, you're fixated on him. You don't care what the plot. You're like, hey, I'm willing to stay with him for the whole movie and not walk out. Another actor, you might walk out.
Yeah, I thought he really registered a lot in his face. I mean, there was a wealth of stuff that he.
Without a doubt.
And it could have been a bore, but and then Rosario Dawson's very good. And the scenes I enjoyed most were them playing off each other.
Mm-hmm. But I would say those are the highlights of the film.
Yeah. So the only movie I haven't yet seen is The Wrestler, and we're all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So and The Reader, I haven't seen The Reader. You have.
But
then
I got to be honest. I don't think The Reader they're going to be talking about after the new year.
Or Revolutionary Road. I haven't seen that either. So maybe I am far behind.
No, you're actually. I would say if you've seen a Slumdog Millionaire, may
right.
I be very honest with you. You've seen probably what the best winner of 2008.
Yeah. I've seen Slumdog Milk, Frost Nixon, Gran Torino.
Yeah, but I mean, I think if you've
seen all
Slumdog,
the documentaries. Yeah.
If you've seen Slumdog, I have a very strong feeling that's the best film of 2008.
It's been a long time coming because there's always these little audience favorites,
mm-hmm.
Feel-good audience favorites that have been in the running for Best Picture, and it's been working up to an eventual win for one of these things.
And I think this is the one.
Yeah, yeah. So go see it. It opened up big. So did The Wrestler. Wrestler only played like... 4 theaters or something.
Yeah, but that's
a
big one. That's going to be everyone wants to see it. I think it's really more Mickey Rourke than anything else, but I have a feeling like when I go see it that it's going to be about a lot of things, but that's Mickey Rourke all the way.
Yeah, you read reviews that either say it's a shallow shameful movie or you read that it's breathtaking.
How is it shallow and shameful? How is that possible? Let me ask you that.
Inauthentic.
Well, let's put it like this. Let's say this right now. As much as it is autobiographical for Mickey Rourke and to an extent, Marissa Tomei, it's really also about Darren Aronofsky, because you could look at it to the reaction to his last film, The Fountain, and he had
right.
something to prove with this film.
Right.
So, I actually think The Wrestler could be, besides Rourke's performance, which is an incredible thing within itself, I think The Wrestler, you know, people are selling it short, personally.
Yeah. It's all over the map.
Yeah.
The notices for it, which is odd. But
yeah.
that's usually the sign of a really distinctive, great movie. You know, when
mm-hmm.
people
yeah.
hate it
oh,
or
absolutely.
People adore it. Yeah. Okay, happy holidays.
Happy holidays,
Merry,
everyone.
Merry Christmas, whatever you want to say. We're so politically correct on this show.
Oh, yeah, really. So politically correct.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We've had a great time, and we'll see you next Sunday, guys.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, people.